I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats are nervous about keeping their edge with women voters after a Democratic strategist named Hillary Rosen went on CNN on Wednesday and said this about Ann Romney, the stay-at-home, mother-of-five wife of Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney.
What you have is Mitt Romney running around the country saying, well, you know, my wife tells me that what women really care about are economic issues. And when I listen to my wife, that's what I'm hearing. Guess what? His wife has actually never worked a day in her life.
Not surprisingly, Republicans who've been struggling in the polls among female voters jumped all over Rosen's remark. It prompted Ann Romney to create a Twitter account that now has more than 30,000 followers. And even the president and Michelle Obama felt compelled to weigh in. They criticized the comment. Yesterday afternoon, Rosen apologized, and today she canceled a planned appearance on Meet the Press. We heard from some people on Facebook and Twitter who said the remark wasn't smart politics and it puts the Romneys in a more favorable light. But the prominent Washington Post blogger Ezra Klein tweeted that, quote, literally no one involved in or covering Rosengate seriously believes this will matter to even one voter in November. So let's bring in Karen Tumulty. She's a national political correspondent who's been covering this for The Washington Post. Karen, would you first give us your take on whether this is largely a media firestorm or whether it really could make some voters decide to support Republicans rather than Democrats in the fall elections?
Well, I think it is a media firestorm, but it's a media firestorm because I think it resonates, first of all, on a debate that women in this country have been having for decades, and it was one point it was known as the mommy wars. And I think it also kind of spoke a little bit to the insecurity and self-doubt that all of us have, all of us mothers working in the house or outside of it, have about our own choices. And by the way, for many, many women, it's not a choice, it's a necessity.
And as far as how it may impact fall elections, do you think it actually could influence voters one way or the other?
No, I think it has taken the Republicans off of defense, which is where they were on women's issues. The Obama campaign has been pounding them on everything from contraception to equal pay, and just gave them, you know, it gave them a day or two of being able to go on offense. But the fact is, Mitt Romney is struggling with a double-digit gender gap that is large even by historical standards. Republicans always tend to run behind among women. But I don't think this whole thing is going to do much to solve that.
Hillary Rosen, the strategist who made the comment, said that she stated her case poorly and that the point she meant to make is that Ann Romney had the luxury of choosing whether to work outside the home, whereas most American women have to work. Let's listen to how Ann Romney responded to Rosen on Fox TV yesterday.
Other women make other choices to have a career and raise family, which I think Hillary Rosen has actually done herself. I respect that. That's wonderful. We have to respect women in all those choices that they make.
Karen, how do you think Rosen's comment resonates with women in general?
Well, again, I think on two levels. That, you know, first of all, Ann Romney has lived a privileged life, but that does not necessarily mean she is not a good sounding board for her husband, because she is out there in the country talking to a lot of women. And I also think that, you know, personally attacking a candidate's spouse, and especially for a choice that is as personal as this one, was a bad move.
And a spouse that the public seems to generally like when they see her out on the campaign trail.
You know, and that's one of the things that's really interesting, because when Mitt Romney began his political career almost two decades ago, Ann Romney was often mocked for her very traditional marriage. At one point, she said she and Mitt Romney had never had a serious disagreement, and at another point she said that having to draw down their stock in college had had them living on the edge. But she has become a very, very poised and appealing campaigner, and especially because she has had some struggles in her life, not financial ones, but health ones.
And in that sense has become a valuable asset for the Romney camp.
Absolutely. I think this one thing this controversy has done is Republican pollster Linda Duvall told me yesterday is it's done much more to humanize Romney than anything that the campaign has done.
Exactly. Karen Tumulty is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you.
And thank you, Sasha.
Now from the role of women in the U.S. to their role in Egypt. During the uprising in the Tahrir Square last year that ultimately brought down Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, an anchor for Egypt's state-owned Nile TV walked off the set in protest. Her name is Shahira Amin, and here she is speaking with Al Jazeera TV after quitting her job.
I'm just going to hold for a moment because I've been told on the line is Shahira Amin. Shahira, talk to me. What have you done?
I'm here in Tahrir Square, and I'm determined to be on the side of the people, not the regime. I can't be part of the propaganda machine. I'm not going to feed the public lies.
Shahira Amin was recently in Boston, and she came to our studios to talk about the discrimination that women still face in Egypt, the upcoming presidential elections, and the reason why she ditched her high-profile job at the height of the Arab Spring.
The reason I walked out was I was given press releases to read, handed to me by my boss. She had gotten them from the Interior Ministry, that said stuff like, there are no clashes, but five people died today. So how did they die, you know? And they blamed the Muslim Brotherhood for fomenting the unrest. And I knew this wasn't true. I had been to Tahrir and seen that this was an all-inclusive people's movement. Everyone was out there demanding change. Muslims, Christians, poor, rich, the educated, the uneducated. And then the Battle of the Camels happened on the 2nd of February. Men on horseback and camelback stormed into Tahrir Square and attacked the peaceful activists with whips and batons, and like a scene from medieval times. And I watched it with horror on Al Arabiya, one of the satellite channels. And then when I was given the news, there was absolutely no mention of what had happened. And I asked the editor-in-chief, you know, I said, we should be telling the world what is happening. And she said, we are given clear instructions not to mention it, don't you dare. And that's when I decided I'm not doing this. I didn't want to be implicated in the crimes of the regime, because state television is a propaganda tool for that regime.
You have a daughter who was part of the protests, is that correct?
Yes, my daughter is a freelance photographer, and she was out there taking pictures, and that's when I decided to go with her and protect her. And I saw that what was being broadcast on state TV was very different from what was really happening.
You have said that in some ways what happened in Tahrir Square was a turning point for women in Egypt. In what way?
The fact that they were out there with the men, you know, they had been given a voice at last. We hadn't heard women's voices in a long time. But they were there not just in support roles, not just conducting the security checks and distributing food and treating the injured. They were there leading at times the protests and having the men chant behind them. So this was a turning point.
Shahira, what did it feel like for you as a female anchor reporter watching that in Tahrir Square?
Amazing. The reason I quit was that I had felt my hands were tied and I wasn't able to tell the story. But then I stayed in Tahrir from the 2nd of February until the 11th, when Mubarak was forced out. It was an amazing time because I was there as an Egyptian national wanting change, but also as a journalist being able to report.
You eventually went back to state TV, where you have a show now, and you have said that you have felt that if you mentioned the army, that that story may not be aired. Do you feel like you're still under the same restrictions that you were before?
State TV hasn't changed much. It's still under the control of the military regime. The journalists there are still practicing self-censorship. And
self-censorship?
Absolutely, because it's a very repressive atmosphere. You know, they have replaced Mubarak with the military authority as the new red line that they cannot cross. And we have a new minister of information who's a military general. And of course, he's there just to continue to control the media. The military has been intimidating journalists. Several have been called in for investigation by the military prosecutor. Bloggers have been put behind bars simply for expressing their views on Facebook. So the atmosphere is still very repressive. But the good news is that there has been a revolution in the media, in the independent media, because a number of new independent or private channels have been launched, new publications, and there is freedom there that isn't there at state television.
If that's the case, why do you choose to stay at state television rather than go to that new emerging independent media where you might have total freedom?
The reason I went back is to push for reforms at state media, because you can only do that as an insider by pushing the freedom boundaries. and many of my fellow colleagues at work staged a sit-in last month demanding an end to censorship and, you know, asking the military to lift their hands off the media. So things are happening, and we just have to remain resilient and keep pushing for change. And I find that that's what the activists are doing, and there's no going back. You know, the momentum has started, it's irreversible, and we shall continue.
You've also made some very interesting comments about how, although many people in Egypt seem newly empowered to be political and to speak out, you're not sure how much impact that has because they are individuals rather than a group. What are some of the mistakes you would say have been made?
The fact that the liberals of Egypt, for instance, are so fragmented and divided, they could have countered the Islamic tide had they been a united, strong force.
And of course, Islamist parties dominate the parliament now. So is that a setback?
Not really, because this is the first freely elected parliament, although the elections weren't 100% free and fair. But, you know, these are our first relatively free elections. And so this is the choice of the people. And if we are to be a democratic state, then we have to respect the choice of the majority. So they're there because people voted for them. And I find that the Muslim Brotherhood are moderate. You know, they are reforming, they are changing, and alienating them would only radicalize them more. The fact that they're now out in the light, I have hope that they will become less rigid and more moderate.
Because, as you know, there have been fears that if it is a heavily Islamist parliament, it will push Egypt to become more conservative. But you actually think this might be a moderately...
I think it will have a diluting effect on them, yes. The fact that they are no longer marginalized and persecuted.
In terms of women in parliament, initially there had been a mandated number, but then that shifted, and I think at some point each slate only had to have one woman. So the parliament is not as female now as I think some people had hoped it would be. How do you feel about that?
That is a huge disappointment, because the quota that had reserved 64 seats for women in parliament has been scrapped, and now we find only 9 women in parliament out of 508 seats. And of course, that is a terrible setback for women, the fact that they're not represented in parliament. But the good news, Sasha, is that the level of activism among women is unprecedented. You know, they feel that they now have a stake in their country, and they want to be part of the political process too.
That's Shahira Amin. She made international news when she quit her job as an anchor for Egypt State TV during the Tahrir Square uprising last year. We spoke with her during her recent visit to Boston, and she told us that although women's roles are changing in Egypt, there's still widespread discrimination. She also says she's even been harassed on the street for not wearing a hijab, the traditional head covering of Muslim women.
I never wear a hijab simply because I don't believe I should wear a hijab. And I'm not the only one getting harassed because I'm without a hijab. There are lots of others who are totally covered up and who still get harassed on the streets. Unfortunately, this is part of the culture, and it's something that has to change. Sexual harassment on the streets of Cairo, groping and verbal abuse is something that has actually increased since the revolution. And I think it's because of the growing public anger over the unmet expectations. So there is a lot of frustration. Men are venting their anger on the women. And also they see women as competitors for jobs. When they see women on public transport going to work, they get angry because they themselves can't find jobs. So they see these women as competing for jobs, for the limited jobs that there are.
At one point, you had a fairly lengthy one-on-one interview with Mubarak himself, and you said you walked out of the interview feeling sorry for him, that he was this outcast who really was out of touch. What was it that you felt he didn't understand about the world around him that left you feeling that way?
He was totally out of touch with the people. He had no idea. He really believed himself to be the wise man of the Middle East, and that every Arab leader who should follow his advice. And he just didn't know about the people's grievances and their anger. 40% of Egyptians live under the $2 a day poverty line. There's 40% illiteracy rate in Egypt. Egypt is a rich country. We have tourism, the Suez Canal revenues, and when you find that half the population is living under such miserable conditions, you know, and him not being aware of all of this, thinking that he's doing his best. The economy was doing well, but the wealth wasn't trickling down to the masses.
Shahira Amin, I want to turn back to the elections. There are thousands of people who hope to try to run. Are these viable candidacies?
Not really. We have over 1,000, as you mentioned earlier, running for the presidency, and some of them are drug dealers, taxi drivers, housemaids. So I think in the end it'll be around 30. And the very serious ones are, I know that the military has fielded some of its own candidates, so they seem adamant to want to maintain power in Egypt. But I know that the Egyptians see that they've made such a mess of the transitional phase, and we want them back to the barracks. And that's where we'll try to push them. We, when I say we, I'm talking about the revolutionary movements. But then there are also there's the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, who appears to be the most popular at the moment, Abu al-Futuh. And the Salafis, the ultra-conservatives, have also fielded a candidate. So it's a mixture, and the Egyptian people will have the final word, I think.
On the issue of the army, which, as you've said, people would like to push back, does the army have any interest or show any inclination to be willing to be pushed back?
They keep saying that they can't wait to go back to the barracks, but this doesn't appear to be the case.
They can't wait to step out of politics and hand it off to someone else. But you're skeptical that that's truly how they feel.
Because they've seen Mubarak on the stretcher in the courtroom, and they know that they will likely follow because it's the same corrupt regime. And so I think they want to be guaranteed a safe exit. They also want to shield their budget from public scrutiny. As you know, they own 40% of the Egyptian economy, maybe more, and this is what they have at stake.
So how does even a powerful people's movement bring down an army?
I think that I totally believe in people power. It works. We've seen the case of the virginity tests when one of the female protesters who had had a virginity check performed on her by the military filed a lawsuit against the military and won the case because she had a ruling at the end saying that this would never happen again in Egyptian military prisons.
This is a story you broke, Shahira, about, I believe, female protesters at Tahrir basically being forced to go through tests to prove that they are virgins.
Exactly. This was on the 9th of March. They were arrested and detained and had these tests performed publicly in front of the soldiers to break and humiliate them. This is the admission I got from a senior military general. When I asked about the tests, he said, "This isn't your daughter or mine. These were girls who had camped out in Tahrir, as if they had gotten what they deserved." So this very brave girl decided to speak out and file the lawsuit. She's very brave, Samira Ibrahim. And in December, we had the ruling saying that this would never happen again.
Quite recently, one of the doctors accused in that case was acquitted. Was that a disappointment for you?
That was a huge disappointment, but outside the courtroom, there was overwhelming support for Samira, and there were hundreds of activists out there chanting, "Samira, raise your head. You are more honorable than those who did this to you." So she does have support.
Would you say that there is any noticeable difference now simply walking around Cairo now than there was before Tahrir Square and before Mubarak was out?
There is still a mood of depression because people expected change to happen quickly. We forced Mubarak out in 18 days, so they expected rapid, radical changes, which haven't happened. So people feel let down, disappointed, but at least the hope is there, whereas there was despair before. There was frustration, there was a total sense that nothing will ever change, total apathy, but now there is the hope. And that is what keeps us going.
That's Shahira Amin of Egyptian State TV. She talked with us when she was recently in Boston to speak at Harvard. The World Trade Organization says it now expects the growth in global trade this year to dip to 3.7%. That's down from 5% last year. The WTO blames the slowdown on a stall in China's projected growth rate and on economic shocks like the Eurozone debt crisis. Nowhere in Europe is the financial crisis more pronounced than in Greece. The country is buried under huge debt. But one city in the center of the country, a place called Volos, is taking matters into its own hands. It's formed an alternative currency to the euro. The BBC's Mark Lowen reports.
It's market day here in Volos, a pretty port city in central Greece. But this is no ordinary market. Everything on sale here today, from clothes to eggs, is through an alternative local currency called TEM. It works as an exchange system. If you have goods or services to offer, you build up credit. 1 euro equals 1 TEM. You can then use it to buy whatever you like. It's a basic idea for people whose savings in euros are wearing thin.
I'm selling kids' underwear, and I can get lessons to learn some languages, to learn a computer. It's a good idea because we need to make people aware that we can all sell something, we can all buy something, we don't need to use only euros.
I teach yoga, so I will offer some session of yoga. It is great for this period with all this financial crisis, yeah. I think it is the next step for the humanity.
We have reached the bottom of our lives. Now we want to think in a different way.
Okay.
The whole system is organized online. Computers are set up at the market to process the transactions. The TEM you spend is transferred between accounts, with goods exchanged for equivalent prices. It's all reminiscent of an ancient bartering system returning to today's Greece, a grassroots initiative that has now built up over 800 members here. The founder is Yanis Grigoriou.
It's attractive because people find hope here. They find things to share.
Do you think that it could eventually become the sort of dominant currency here?
I don't know, maybe. We'll see.
But Volos' mayor, Panos Kotiniotis, says the euro is not in danger from TEM. He has officially backed the project, but believes the two currencies can coexist.
Greece is in the eurozone. We want to remain in the eurozone. We think that we must remain in the euro.
But the alternative currency network is expanding throughout the town, and many here are growing increasingly dependent upon it. At a local flower-growing cooperative, workers now sell their plants through TEM, allowing them to afford goods and services in tough times. Peri Manzafleri runs the business.
TEM gives us the chance to sell our products and to have work done here that we can't do. So, for example, people come and cut the grass. We can buy bread or meat in exchange for our products. The girls can go to the hairdresser. I grew up in a village. This was how it used to work in the old days, before money became involved. So this could be a chance to start again.
The initiative is now stretching to all ages. I'm at a workshop organised by the local authority here in Volos for kids of 7 to 8 years old who listen to music, sing songs, draw and play games. Parents who can't afford the full fee in euros can pay 30% of it in the alternative currency. The two methods of payment working hand in hand.
We have a lot of people that cannot afford to pay these educational programs, and it's a good opportunity for them to pay in TEM.
Charalampos Pardas coordinates the project.
This local currency is a big solution against this crisis. Life goes on, we have to continue, we have to battle, we have to fight. We have to see things different now. We don't want to stop. It's not the end of the world if we have this crisis. We want to succeed and move on.
And so the next generation, too, is learning how to adapt to a new Greece, a country which is suffering in ways nobody here expected and is now finding new tools to fight back. Greece is determined to stay in the euro, but Volos is showing how a community can cope through alternative means. A simple bartering system, exchanging despair for hope.
The BBC's Mark Lowen in Volos, Greece. Remember when ethanol made from corn was the next big thing in energy? It was going to power all of our cars. Well, ethanol isn't in the news much anymore, but it turns out it's grown even bigger than that hype. That's obviously good news for ethanol producers, but it worries environmentalists who say ethanol isn't much cleaner than gasoline. We're catching up on the ethanol industry with Micheline Maynard, who goes by Mickey. She's senior editor for the public media project Changing Gears and a contributor to Forbes magazine, and she joins us from the studios of Michigan Radio. Mickey, would you start off with some numbers? For example, how much ethanol is being produced now?
I'll be happy to. So let me just take you back to about 2007, which is when the ethanol interest began. At the time, the government said that by now, about 30% of the corn supply in the country would be used for ethanol production. And they thought that would be about 11 billion gallons of fuel. Well, we're actually using 40% of the corn supply for ethanol, and that's almost 14 billion gallons of ethanol. And if you think about it another way, we're now using more corn to produce fuel than we are to feed livestock. And that was always the main use of this kind of corn.
Which is quite amazing. Again, we see all that corn growing and think it's animal feed, it's going to go in our food, and it turns out that that's quickly not so much becoming the case anymore.
That's right. And one of the reasons that this became the case is that people probably don't know that regular gasoline, I guess you'd call it unleaded, that people buy, any kind of gasoline except for diesel fuel, is about 10% ethanol. So there's ethanol in all of our cars if we're using conventional gasoline.
Could you give us a sense of how that ethanol production or consumption compares to gasoline production and consumption?
Well, gasoline production is much, much, much higher. Ethanol is just a little component of regular gasoline. But the idea of ethanol was that it would help us wean our dependence on foreign oil and on conventional gasoline in general. And that has definitely been true. When you take 10% of gasoline and put in 10% ethanol, that's what happens. What they're looking at now is another kind of ethanol, which would be called E15, and that would be 15% ethanol. And that is the latest thing that's being talked about in the energy community.
Mickey Maynard, one of your reporters went to an ethanol refinery in Michigan, a place called Carbon Green Energy. And what he found was somewhat surprising in terms of supply and demand. Would you tell us about that?
That's exactly right. Dustin Dwyer, who is our web editor and a reporter here at the Changing Gears Project, went to visit them. And what he found was that they're developing 50 million gallons of gasoline a year, ethanol a year, just at this one factory in Michigan. And essentially, they said there is no drop in demand. We expect that this demand will continue.
And I believe the production was even greater than the plant's intended capacity.
That's exactly right.
Now, is this all purely market supply and demand? Because I understand there's some federal role in this jump in production in the form of subsidies. Is there a way to easily explain that?
It's a little bit fuzzy, but let me explain that the federal government has been supporting ethanol production for something like 40 years. This is not a new thing in terms of federal subsidies. But what happened recently was in January, that old subsidy was essentially discontinued by Congress. But there are other subsidies that were put in place back in the late part of the most recent decade when we were cranking up our thoughts that we wanted to get away from dependence on foreign oil. So while that traditional subsidy has gone away, other subsidies are still around, although they're being phased out as well.
There have also been some tariffs that made it expensive for ethanol produced in other countries like Brazil to come into the U.S., but those tariffs are going to be ending. Do you expect that to have an impact on the U.S. industry?
See, this will be what will be fascinating about this whole situation, because the hype over ethanol is over. And yet ethanol producers are talking about a new form called E15, and it will depend on what happens with gasoline prices. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line for everybody involved in the energy business. If gas prices actually go way up above $4 a gallon, $5 a gallon, we will probably be talking about ethanol on a future program. But if gas prices are kind of where they're going to be and then they stop dropping, I think there will be less interest in it.
Ethanol certainly has drawbacks as well. Among them is that it's not very easy to transport by pipelines, and so it requires an entirely different infrastructure to move it. Would you tell us a little bit about that?
That's absolutely true. Ethanol actually takes a lot of energy to produce. And this was one of the things that environmentalists brought up back in the late part of the last decade. They basically said, why are we devoting all of these fields of corn to developing fuel when it's using energy to produce a fuel that can be used as energy? The other thing that people need to know about ethanol is if you're just going to drive your car based on ethanol, you are going to get not as good fuel economy and the pump that you get, the sort of push that you get in your car, the acceleration, whatever you want to call it, you're not going to get that thrust that you would get from a normal gallon of gasoline. And so it's not like you can just pull up to a gasoline station, fill up an ethanol pump, fill up your car, and you're going to get the same kind of performance. That's just not the case.
So both not as much power, perhaps, and then maybe more frequent trips to the gas station.
That's exactly right. And also ethanol, until recently, had been more expensive than gasoline. But ethanol prices have come down. And that is something that the proponents of ethanol say may help it going forward, that if there's an awareness again that we need to wean ourselves from foreign oil, from even domestically produced oil, there may be interest in ethanol as long as the price stays close to that of unleaded.
Mickey Maynard, on a non-ethanol question, you've covered the car industry for a long time, and we came across a stat this week that we're hoping you can help us explain. And that stat said that only about 35% of hybrid car owners bought another hybrid when it came time for them to buy a new car. Do you have any idea why that would be?
There's a couple reasons why that's true, and I think until recently one of them was maybe Toyota's fault, you could say. Toyota produces the Prius, which is actually a vehicle that I own. And the Prius for the last 10 years has come in only one size, like the old Model T. So that essentially, if you outgrow the Prius, if your family gets too big, if your needs change, if you owned a Prius, there wasn't any place else that you probably wanted to go. So you went back to a conventionally gasoline-powered car. In the last couple of months, Prius has expanded its lineup and added two new vehicles, and their sales have really taken off. I believe they had record sales of hybrids, their hybrid, in March. And so what we're seeing is that the people who make hybrids are realizing that they have to expand the lineups of these pure hybrids. Now, as far as 35% goes, it's not as bad as it sounds, because car makers talk about owner loyalty, and 35 to 50% is kind of that sweet spot. They want you to come back for their vehicles. So it probably doesn't look as bad as it sounds.
So maybe it doesn't indicate dissatisfaction with people dumping their hybrid. It's just they needed a different kind of car. They may like the hybrid, so they go elsewhere.
Yeah, I think they just haven't made enough choices.
Mickey, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This coming Monday marks the 116th running of the Boston Marathon, and the weather forecast is calling for temperatures in the 80s, so the stage could be set for another duel in the sun. That's the way one of the most famous races in the long history of the Boston Marathon is described, and this year is the 30th anniversary of that ferocious battle between Alberto Salazar and Dick Beardsley.
Alberto Salazar has won the 1982 Boston Marathon! An extremely gutty Dick Beardsley finishing right behind.
They raced each other neck and neck over the last 9 miles of the race until Salazar, with a final surge, edged out Beardsley by just 2 seconds. Author John Brandt devoted an entire book to that race and to what happened to the two men in the years after it. His book is called Duel in the Sun, and he told Here and Now's Alex Ashlock that the effort that day took a huge toll on both runners.
Dick was running so hard and so out of his mind that day that he couldn't feel his legs. The whole last 7 or 8 miles of the race is like his legs didn't exist. He was running so hard and so fast, he had lost touch with himself. And about a half mile to the finish, he was still leading, or a quarter mile, but not very far at all. He developed a knot in his hamstring, and it was very painful, and he thought that this was finally going to finish him, and Alberto would just fly by him. And Alberto did go by him finally in the last several hundred yards. And at that point, Dick stepped in a pothole, and he thought that was going to ruin him completely. But stepping in that pothole actually helped ease the hamstring, and he actually made a sprint, got back on Alberto's shoulder. And he was just about there when the marathon finished with Alberto a couple strides ahead. So it was just a phenomenally courageous, gutsy, brilliant performance by both runners. And it was expected of Alberto, although not quite in that way. But for Dick to do it was a real sensation.
What happens to these two runners after this race, maybe even more dramatic than what happened during the race? They both have incredible problems, personal problems in their lives. Dick Beardsley has a farming accident and winds up getting addicted to painkillers.
I always felt, researching and reporting the story, that besides being a great race, great sporting event, it was almost like two lives came together at this marathon for just under 2 hours and 9 minutes. And it was like some sort of great unconscious force greater than both of them brought them together to have this sort of Custer and Little Bighorn type experience. And then after that, neither man was ever the same as an athlete or as a person. That was the last really first-rate marathon Dick ever ran. He was 26 years old, and it was hoped that he was on his way to be just a great marathoner for a long time. But he ran so hard in that race that his Achilles tendon was never the same. He eventually had surgery, and he tried to hang on for a couple more years as a professional distance runner, but eventually retired in 1989. And Dick, being Dick, went right back to where he was before he started his running career. He went back to a dairy farm in Minnesota, right on the border with Wisconsin. One day in November of 1989, he was involved in a terrible farm accident with a tractor that very nearly killed him and crippled him. Luckily, he survived the injuries and recovered from them, but in the process, he was given big doses of painkillers, and he became addicted to them. He was not merely just addicted. He was addicted in a felony way. He was writing hundreds of prescriptions, forging a doctor's name, and he was taking up to 80 and 90 pills a day at one point. And he was probably a week or two away from dying when he finally got caught in 1995.
What happens to Alberto Salazar may be a little bit more subtle. He begins to suffer illnesses after he runs this incredible marathon against Beardsley. Eventually, they figure out that what he's really suffering from is depression.
For a long 10 or 15 year period, the depression was sort of mixed up with his physical condition. The speculation was that by running so hard at the Boston Marathon, running so hard and so fast and drinking on a hot day and drinking such small amount of water, he really screwed up his body's thermostat, his hypothalamus, his whole physical system was sort of thrown out of whack by this tremendous effort. He suffered a string of bad colds that he couldn't recover from. His running performances went slowly downhill until finally it was an effort for Alberto to run even 7 or 8 minutes a mile, as fast as maybe just an everyday jogger. And as his performance as an athlete declined, this depression came on, because Alberto defined himself almost completely through his running and through his marathoning, as many great and accomplished athletes would, but especially with Alberto. And like many depressed people, he was able to pretty much hide it from the world. He went about his business. He lived in Eugene, Oregon. He owned a restaurant. He kept trying to run. He was a successful businessman, had a wonderful family. But underneath it all, he was racked by a nearly suicidal depression. It was a really dark time for him. And interestingly, one of the many parallels between these two men, Beardsley was able to hide his disease, his drug addiction, and Alberto was able to hide for a while his depression. But of course, you can't hide forever.
What ends up helping him probably more than anything else is he basically goes back to his faith, his religious faith, and he has sort of a spiritual awakening. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
During the same time that Alberto was suffering his depression, Alberto's father, Jose, undertook this pilgrimage to Medjugorje, which is a village in Croatia, where in the 1980s, a purported miracle was supposed to occur, an apparition of the Virgin Mary appearing. And he made a pilgrimage and experienced what he perceived were miracles himself. And he came back, and of course he tried to get his son Alberto interested in this too. And Alberto at first resisted, but finally at the end of his rope, couldn't run, depressed. And it ended up that Alberto took his family to Medjugorje as well, where he underwent a reawakening that changed his life.
Do you think there are any days that go by in these men's lives today when they don't think back about this race?
I think it's always there on some layer. Of course, Dick now makes his living during the summer as a fishing guide in Detroit Lakes, Minnesota. If you're ever in that part of the world, I suggest you trying to do it. You'll have a great day on the lake with Dick. The rest of the year, he's a motivational speaker. He talks at a lot of road races, but he also does a lot of speaking with 12-step groups. One of his most requested stories is the one of the duel in the sun in 1982 Boston Marathon. So I think it's on Dick's mind a lot, probably on a daily basis, that he understood that that was sort of a culminating experience of his life, although it happened when he was still a young man, but it almost destroyed him, and ultimately it saved him, too. I think Dick is aware of it every day. Alberto might be in a more subtle, unconscious sense. Alberto is now a coach. He works for Nike, and his mission is to produce the next great American distance runner. So Alberto is working with young athletes, and in the one sense, he tries to prevent them from making the same mistakes that he did. But on the other hand, he also tries to drive them to the extent that he ran and also save them, too. So it's kind of subtle, maybe impossible balancing act trying to guide these runners. And I think that his experience at 82 Boston is always right there behind it.
What kind of a relationship did these two guys have today? Are they friends?
Alberto sort of resented Dick. I think he sort of regarded him as a guy who had one lucky day. And because of that lucky day in April of 82, he unwittingly but still helped destroy Alberto Salazar. So Alberto kind of resented Beardsley for a long time. And Dick always was sort of intimidated by Alberto to a great degree. And they really didn't have much contact for decades. Finally, in 2002, for the 20th anniversary of their duel in the Sun, the Boston Marathon brought them back together. And, of course, by this time, they'd all been through their respective travails, and they had a greater wisdom and sense of perspective. And they started talking and reflecting on what happened in their lives since the marathon, and they ended up becoming quite good friends. Every few weeks or every few months, Alberto or Dick will pick up the phone and they'll give each other a call. And of course, they realize they have this bond that they'll never escape.
That's author John Brandt speaking with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. You can read an excerpt of Duel in the Sun at hereandnow.org. By the way, Alberto Salazar and Dick Beardsley will be talking about the 1982 race at the Boston Public Library on Sunday afternoon, if you happen to be in the Boston area. And on Monday on Here and Now, Alex will have a conversation with Salazar about his new book, 14 Minutes, A Running Legend's Life and Death and Life. He survived a heart attack in 2007 that left him technically dead for 14 minutes. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Robin Young returns on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.